We have now half an hour empty place for a full discussion about the speeches of this afternoon, and I will give speech to anybody who has questions or remarks or supplements of information to bring us.
I want to ask Professor England. I agree, I want to believe your idea. You said you found this sign in the Uruk period is a slave names. But maybe I didn't understand that. How do you know they are slave? Could they are free citizens or free person?
That's only an iconic decision based on a couple of things. First, the depiction of these groups of slaves that they are, that's in the Revelation 1 to 12, that qualifies groups of Saul and Kuar as being some with a noose around and the other being a yoke. That's a rather good and close hit with the Lacanian depictions of prisoners being let down either with the noose around their necks or back in shackles that is a permanent like the Adams. It goes back to a very long discussion by Python, who wrote closely not at these texts, but at your texts where you have lots of attestations of Saul and Kuar, and discovered, interestingly enough, that at another angle, the bookkeeping for these persons was precisely parallel to the bookkeeping for domesticated animals, namely that the children of the Saul Kuar were identified with the rotation of sides that were rotated 90 degrees to the right. So you did this beautiful thing, where if you have exactly the same rotation for young calves as you do for the youngsters of Saul and Kuar. And it makes better sense than looking at it in any other way. Of course, it goes back ultimately to the gaining reading of Saul Kuar, stating that that the woman from the mountain should be the slave that of later tradition. And when that split, as Lyman showed, that the two of them actually are to one side domination, but are referring specifically to males and females, it still makes sense that the male, if it's correct, that the male in fact is represented by the sign of the mountain, that these would have been the classic source for lots of chattel slaves in Mesopotamia, namely slaves who were taken prisoner during wars around those days. So I think a lot of things play into that. I'm very happy to hear a theory that propounds some other solution to the identification of these. I can also say that I put up some other categories, one being Song itself. Song is shown in one important text to be a higher category representing the combinations of Song and Kuar. And there's one also funny thing that is Sue and Puck, least the messenger of animals that will listen when you call about that.
Another question. Jerry?
Well, I'm curious about Bob's response to the suggested genetic elements in the archaic writing.
The Mexico list?
Yeah.
Well, I thought that might better be a private discussion. But I frankly, but it looked to me like most of the recommendations were assigning possible readings of science to specific science in specific contexts that could have hit a different other region. So I didn't see in maybe not in one instance a proposal that was anyway compelling. Maybe you say as a blogger that seems like there may be a lot of features that these could be correct. But I would think for me it would have been better to have a presentation that said I have hard and I have soft evidence. So for those of us who like to see things like this and say here's the hard evidence where we think there might be a genetic shade, there's shade, what was that shade we should make this thing? That obviously depends. I'm sure you could come up with a half a dozen equally possible representations for that particular reading that would exclude any studied genetic reading. And I think that would have been the case right down the line. I can't say that we haven't looked at those very closely and others haven't looked and thought about that. You know, this, I might mention, Craven had mentioned during some article, this was in the list, the attestation of Giosu in the geographical list. Well, I find that quite good. I mean, after all, really, you know, and if we have that here, we look, so soon might be a little bit difficult, but from here too, that already looks like they have like quite a strong attestation. And Shabu was actually quite good for genetic use of text. These myths, I think, that don't have very good sort of additional gloss power did not impress me. Without wanting to be disrespectful.
It's a matter of counting this question. Oh, sorry.
Those that are, I think, much stronger. And there won't be as great.
Yes, yes. I'm sorry, as I presided, I have
that term Steinkeller objection. Is it the kind of objection Steinkeller makes, or an objection to the kind of thing Steinkeller does?
Objection to the diction of the Steinkeller article.
Just like to add one thing, and the EBLA material, of course, is very important and was not used completely until now. And you seem to have. It's difficult to speak about your paper because we don't remember all the examples. And each time it's a long discussion and a long reflection, which you have had. Then we are waiting for the publication, I hope, and for more information. I would like for the tribute, so-called tribute text, which is attested in Uruk period to the Old Babylonian period, in the same way, with the two first lines as an introduction. And this introduction is written from Uruk on in mainly syllabic Sumerian. And the meaning of the two sentences is exactly the same from Uruk to Old Babylonian. Here we have, thanks to the Old Babylonian period and Ur 3, and the testimony in Farah, or the Farah period, we have here the fantastic duration of a lexical list which was used and taught at school. And the beginning is Sumerian with the 99% of the terms, 10 or 15 terms, I don't remember well, are written syllabically, even in the Uruk period. It's important to remember too. So, yeah.
That's why
yes, there's no break in the tradition, let's say. You what?
Akhal is a Sumerian word, it's odd. I mean, it's not
to attribute a soft sound, what is a soft sound?
part you are waiting for a while. The green thing.
Yeah, the Gearsu example you showed and Bob mentioned, I think is hard evidence that there is phonetics involved in some of these lists. I do not think that we have proof that everything has to be read in Sumerian. But my question to Theo, as I assume, you are correct that the naming in the place names needs or provokes, in fact, syllabic or phonetic writing. How you would explain for the observation of Bob that in personal names you have, as far as I understood you, no trace at all? Would you have an explanation for this?
Well, as we know from the Abbas al-Rubish text, there are a lot of Semitic scribes which write perfect Sumerian, and so it's not excluded that there's another configuration with double breaks in this early stage of what's projected. And it's not excluded that they write another language. So when they the slaves are proof of difference from the world.
But is that question still not in the offer in part this so that you never get ahead into this and maybe you will find something that moves your writing. I'm very much confused if these were at least part in parts.
I think the crucial, most significant development in this whole debated matter is the analysis of context of the signs in the archaic period. Regardless of what language might be present or languages might be present, one shouldn't attempt to find phoneticism in a text isolated from the context of the text. And I think that's very important that Bob Englund and Cale Johnson have been showing that you can't get, you can't explain mother in an administrative text, in a very short administrative text, where you might have, as in the case of Sangha, Ngar, and Ama, what have you got? The administrative priest giving bread to his mother? I mean, one has to find a reasonable explanation for assigning values, regardless of whether they're Semitic values or Sumerian values. And the same thing goes for Indo-European. Unless you can put a reasonable explanation out there for the context of the actual materials, it's not an argument. And I'd like to, although it'll be ironic, I'd like to defend Sumerian here. Every time I hear someone say the place names are non-Sumerian, and at the same time slam any idea that there might have been a language other than Sumerian in Mesopotamia, it's totally illogical, it's methodologically unsound. You have to explain, why is a place name appearing non-Sumerian to you? What you're saying when you say that is that a Sumerian name has to be composed of monosyllables. Because why can't a trisyllabic place name, even, be a perfectly good Sumerian name? It doesn't have to be an transparent compound. And this is a major problem. Mikhailovsky, who, of course, could never be accused of arguing for languages other than Sumerian in the archaic period, himself says all the place names are non-Sumerian. Now, how can one say this? Now, that's the one point I'd like to make. The other one is, although I myself see convincing, for me at least, convincing examples of Sumerian in Uruk 3, and a couple that I can't dismiss for Uruk 4, I have no objection, no problem with the idea of Sumerian being present in the entire archaic period. I argue only myself for the existence of, as in all other periods in Mesopotamian history, at least one other language in the area. And I wouldn't be surprised to find Semitic in the Uruk period, not necessarily the ancestor of Akkadian. But when I see N used for phonetic arguments, I have a problem from a Sumerological standpoint as a non-Sumerologist. And that is, we have to use all the information available to us in determining what kind of phoneticism might have been occurring in this very early period. It's not Ur 3. So when we use basically Neo-Sumerian reading to argue for phoneticism in Uruk 4, when you say N is the reading of the sign for Lord in the Uruk 4 period, what are we dealing with? 1,000 to 1,500, over 1,000 years anyway, of a constant value N, when you have MSL, regardless of whether this is an artificial dialect, a literary dialect, or based on a geographical dialect, it is a consistent body of Sumerian data that has to be included in any attempt to reconstruct as much as possible earlier Sumerian phoneticism, phonology. And this has never been included. Steinkeller, Kravenik, the whole array of fine scholars that have worked on phoneticism in this period have always consistently ignored the problem of sound change over time. And if you've got Umun as an MSR reading for N, you have to explain how N, which looks like a reduced form, can be used phonetically in words like Ezen and, or signs Ezen and Min. You know. So until someone considers all the evidence, and especially the fact that all languages change over time, and 1,000 years is a pretty long period, the job is not done.
I have a suggestion for the Professor Crispin's sign meaning. You know, in your sign list, you have number 8 is bar. You said the picture is division into the half for bar. Yeah. But you know, for the ancient people, invent writing, he always picture or draw the object. I mean, not action, not motions. And in the Sumerian dictionary, it said bars are water animal. And my suggestion is bar in fact is a share. When you want to eat share, you must divide it the two sides. So maybe that's my suggestion.
I agree with you that it is, in fact, it is an object which is depicted. It's it looks like a bowl into half. So, but the word is also used for division, and also used for sasix, which means half in later Sumerian. So the idea with to divide and to be half is already from the origin, from the original times of the sign on. But there is a confusion sometimes with Iki, this period, Iki and Bar, almost the same.
There are no more questions.